Hi, this is Chris Pearson, and over the next hour we're chatting all things Bee Gees and the Isle of Man with Sir Barry Gibb. For years, the Bee Gees' Manx connections were largely forgotten until the late Bernie Quayle pushed to get the full story out there. Stay tuned as Bernie's niece, Christy De Haven, and I chat with Sir Barry here on Manx Radio.
Thank you so much for taking the time, first of all. I mean, I suppose...
It's a pleasure, darling. It's a pleasure.
Do you know what? I'd love to know from you, like, when we're just talking about the Isle of Man, obviously, here, and I'm sort of trying to paint a picture of our beautiful island. But I'm just wondering, when someone says Isle of Man to you, what are some of the first images that come to your mind?
What comes to mind? Everything. Because my memory is very profound. I remember everything about the Isle of Man. It's my island. It's a very spiritual place, and it always will be. And... I used to play in the pits during the TT races with other kids, and they let us do that then. I met Jeff Duke when I was about 5 or 6. Spring Valley. Do you guys remember Spring Valley?
Yes. Yeah.
We lived there for a while, and that was right next to the Walls Ice Cream Factory.
That's right. Ward's, I think it was. Yeah. And didn't you come back and visit it again later?
Well, I will be. But
good man.
I'm just trying to tell you how it came about, you know. Mm-hmm. When I was about 4 or 5, I used to stand on the back of the Walls factory loading zone and pretend to perform. So I didn't know I was doing that, but that must have been the beginning of something.
Wasn't there a particular song that you were singing and your mum dragged you back one night?
None that comes to mind right now, but my mum was always, she was always ironing and she was always singing.
Let's take the story back, Barry. Let's look, and we're talking about your mum and dad. They moved here to the island originally before you were born because your dad had a job with Douglas Corporation, Liverpool to Douglas Ferry.
Yes.
What was his role?
Well, I think he was the band leader. I think he had a 10, 13-piece band, and they played on the boat going to the Isle of Man. And that's all I know of it.
It was also kind of a loose contract, wasn't it? Because the bands never got paid, from what I understand. Your dad sort of ensured they got paid.
So what's changed?
But did he used to go around collecting money, didn't he, to make sure the band got their cash?
Oh, I do not know. I mean, I never experienced that part of his life. And I know that what I learned from the Isle of Man was that it was a place where you kept the Italian people during the war. And... I used to drive around the track. I used to drive around the Isle of Man in any vehicle I could, just so that I would get to know Ramsay and get to know Peel and, you know, all of that. The idea of motorcycles going past your house at a speed that you can't even see them is a thrill. That was a thrill at 5 years old, you know.
Didn't your dad also have a bike? Didn't he have a Norton? And did you go round the TT course on the front of it or something?
My father had a Norton. You know, and he would make me sit on the back, and then he'd go around the track, and I just couldn't handle it. 90 miles an hour on the back seat of a motorcycle. No, I did it a few times, and his passion for motorcycles and the racing, I just sort of got caught up in that, you know.
So TT riding wasn't for you, but he was a big music fan and also a very skilled musician as a drummer himself. Yep. Tell us a bit about the Hugh Gibb Orchestra, Barry.
I don't know them. I never did know the Hugh Gibb Orchestra. So it's like Dad used to mention names now and again, but I never knew them. So I was just too young for that. No, I just don't remember those things. I remember my dad's passion for music. I remember his passion for playing the drums. And later on in life, he played the drums for us in Australia. But that's as much as I remember about his life.
One of his fellow musicians at that stage, from what I've looked at, was a chap by the name of James Cain, a.k.a. Jim the Jazz, who, outside of his successful music career, presented shows here on Manx Radio, a show called Sweet and Swing, which is still going now. Right. Your dad obviously had an ear for good talent here on the island, too.
Well, I guess it was a whole family because Andy had a band on the Isle of Man as well. And it was all one family and the joy of music. And then, of course, there was the crowning of the Queen. That was about 1952, 53. So we were there for that. So we watched that in black and white. And we lived in Williston for a while after Spring Valley.
Didn't you have half of Williston in the house that day watching the coronation?
I think so. I think it was something that was just memorable. You had to watch it.
There comes now yet another ancient ceremony. The Queen will ascend the steps of her throne in the sight today of a great multitude of people.
At the death of King George resonated right through the Isle of Man, and everybody kept saying, God save the King. And I never quite understood that. I've come to understand it, That was the period.
And we're talking about obviously how musical your father was. I mean, Mum had a wonderful voice. She was such a great singer as well, wasn't she? And I'm intrigued to know when you kind of really felt that music yourself. I mean, they must have just have just come through them to you.
Well, Mum was always ironing. And when she was ironing, she was singing. And I would pretend to be ill so I wouldn't have to go to school. And then I would listen to Mum singing half the day when she was ironing. And There's Always Tomorrow was one of my favourites.
There's always tomorrow for dreams to come true. Believe in your dreams, come what may.
Some of Ronnie Hilton, Dickie Valentine, people like that. She was always singing songs, Nat King Cole songs, that I've never forgotten, you know. So I think that triggered me. It really triggered me.
There's a lovely clip from the Bernie interviews with you, because you all got on so well with Bernie, didn't you? You seem to be sort of like kindred spirits, and it's lovely listening back to them. I've been listening back to them again recently. And he has this lovely moment where your mum's in the room and he says, come on over, Barbara, come on over. And she sings with you, and it's the You'll Never Know, that one.
You'll Never Know. There's another one.
You'll never know just how much I miss you. Never know just how much I care.
And I would hear her doing that while she was ironing. So I was learning all these songs that really, I shouldn't have even been hearing it, but she was singing those songs all the time.
In 1997, Max Radio's Bernie Quayle went to meet the family in America at his own cost to spend time with them and hear more about their, until that time, forgotten Manx background. As Christy just mentioned, that same song, You'll Never Know, came up in conversation, and Bernie persuaded Barry, Morris and Robin to join him with Mum Barbara to sing a version in their kitchen.
Those are some of the old songs, the ones that your mother used to sing when you were very small.
Yes. Songs like Answer Me, Always.
Maybe I'm Right.
Nevertheless, I think I don't think Mum ever did that, but when you were just babies, Mum was doing the ironing. no, it's true. She used to sing these songs all the time. And there was Answer Me, and there was...
Ding Dong, Ding Dong Bell, Pussy in the Well.
That was a wonderful
Ding Dong, Pussy in the Well. You bloody did.
Come on, Mum. Get in.
After you've had four or five pints, you'd sing that all the time.
One of your favourite songs, Barry.
It was yours, and there was...
You Will Never Know.
You'll Never Know.
Yeah, that was his favourite.
Right. Go and stand behind Barry over there and just lead him into this. Just a couple of lines of this, Barry.
Oh, come on. Barry,
I don't need to lead Barry into anything.
It would be nice to have Mum singing with you for a moment.
Oh, come on.
You choose the key, Mum.
You start it.
You start it.
What you got? Like what?
You'll never know.
You'll never know just how much.
Yeah, you see, now that's two different keys. You'll never know. You see, I'm in a totally different key than you because you're a woman.
But I miss you, Mama.
Yeah.
You'll never know just how much I care.
I can see the bombs now.
No, no, that was before the bombs.
Oh, sorry.
And if I tried, I still couldn't hide my love for you.
card.
You ought to know, for haven't I told you so? A million or more times you went away and my heart went with you.
Have we done?
Yeah.
I think so.
Bloody awful.
Mum Barbara singing You'll Never Know in the Kitchen for Bernie Quayle in 1997, accompanied by Morris, Robin and Barry. Barry, it sounds like you were surrounded by music from a very young age.
Many, many, many songs.
I think another one that I read about was the Mills Brothers, I Ain't Got Nobody.
Yeah. Well, the Mills Brothers started us. They basically influenced us into being a singing group.
I ain't got nobody, and nobody cares for me.
You know, my father loved them. He used to bring them into the house. He used to bring La Traviata into the house, La Tosca. So there was always an operatic or a classical influence in the family that we weren't necessarily aware of.
And the Mills Brothers was another artist that Bernie asked the brothers about back in 1997.
Did you ever sort of do Mills Brothers stuff together? Or was it just you that liked the Mills Brothers music?
Oh, we all like the Mills Brothers music. But
I love the ballady harmonies. Yes, our father was a very big fan of the Mills Brothers, and he used to always play their records when we were kids. To sort of influence our harmonies and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever try, like they used to imitate the instruments in the band?
Yeah.
We tried, but we were complete failures.
It was bloody awful.
We decided, let's just get real ones.
When you're about 10, 11 years old and you're doing these in clubs and stuff, you can get away with that stuff, you know.
When you're kids.
But when you turn like teenagers, you know, they all go, what the hell are they doing?
The size of a grown-up man trying to do a trumpet is not quite.
Not quite as good as the Mills Brothers, that's for sure. They were brilliant.
Do you remember the harmonies?
on
Alexander.
Oh yeah.
So if I was to choose,
I ride to the highest.
Mama, be my top one.
Na, na, na. I remember the words.
Come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's ragtime band. Come on in here, come on in here, it's the best band in the land. Well, you could play a bugle call like you never heard before.
Cut that out. Cut it out.
But those songs, they don't go away.
Absolutely. And you know, your career, the music you've created is so incredibly varied, especially when you think of, you know, sort of where you started. So I'm sure that's all played a part in it. But we were talking about, obviously, your sort of like earliest memories here on the Isle of Man. And in one of the things that I read or maybe listened to with the chat with Bernie, it sounds like you're quite mischievous because your mum described you as little devils and talks about how Barry got a rocket up his trouser leg on bonfire night.
Oh, bonfire night! Yeah, the rocket up your shorts. I got a rocket, and we cut the tail off it, and then it becomes a squib, and then everybody would stand around and see which way the squib was going to go, and it headed right for me. So I ran up the street at Williston, and the squib went right up my shorts.
Happy memories looking back, maybe, but not so much at the time. Your dad, presumably, the music he was involved with and the fairies and everything else would have been quite seasonal, I'm guessing. So what did he do to make a living off-season to look after the family?
I think he worked in an asylum when we first got to the island. He used to work at the insane asylum, let's call it that. I don't know. I've never seen it. I never heard about it, but he used to tell me stories. You know,
I think he had a bread delivery round, which you helped him with as well at one point.
That's right, the bread round. Yeah, but I used to eat all the bread.
This is where I was going to, Barry. This is where I was going.
Right, I used to eat the insides of the loaf before it was delivered.
Did you ever get caught, or did you get away with it?
No, I was always up to mischief. Very rarely did anybody call me on it. So Never got caught.
You got away with it. You were born at 8:45 in the morning at the Jane Crookle Maternity Home in Domain Road in Douglas, September the 1st, 1946. Your first moment in the limelight, Barry, came in the Douglas Examiner, which published a birth notice saying, Gibb, September 1st, to Barbara, wife of Hugh Gibb of 17 Strand Street in Douglas, a son. So you really had that Manx community connection from day one.
Absolutely. My grandmother ran a boarding house at the bottom of the hill in Douglas. She was there. You know what always entranced me was the idea of the fairies and the cycle track itself, but always to be aware that the fairies were there. And I believed in that then, I believe in that now.
I love that. Again, listening to the chats with Bernie, there was you all you brothers talked about the kind of spirituality of the island and how you felt There was a real connection to it, the sort of Celtic side of it, and how that's also influenced your music to a certain extent too.
Yes, absolutely. I think it did. I think those experiences as a small child, dealing with the idea of spirituality, dealing with the idea that there might be witches, dealing with the idea that there might be fairies. It was a very supernatural feeling living there, you know, as a kid. But I was always getting injured, you know. I was badly scalded when I was about 2. And I don't think I saw real life again until I was about 4. So those are the profound memories, you know.
I have to ask you, the last time you came back, did you still say hello to the fairies as you came through?
Oh, yes. You can't go over the fairy bridge without saying hello.
Good man. You know? Let's take you back as well to that beginning. Robin and Morris were born at Jane Crookle a few years later, 3 years after you.
Yes.
What was it like to suddenly have twin brothers on the scene?
Well, that's not something that's easy to, you know, how do you actually explain how you felt then, you know? But I had had so much emergency situations that I don't remember my twin brothers being born. I don't remember that. So Once we all got to know each other, it worked out just great.
You could say that.
And do you remember those first times of the sort of three of you singing together? Because there is something, isn't there, about sibling harmony and the sort of a magic, isn't there, when siblings sing together? Well, do you remember those first times?
Of course. We were living in Manchester at that point. We've moved back to England. We were living in Manchester. And the three of us were inspired by our father bringing these records home. So we decided to be a singing group, but we only had brushes and tin cans on top of them to use as pretend microphones, you know. So we would do that in the little lounge in Keppel Road in Manchester. And that was how we honed our skills, if you like.
Presumably that was the same sort of thing and at the same sort of time that the skiffle groups were becoming a big thing.
Absolutely. Lonnie Donegan, we worshipped. Tommy Steele. The Don Lang Five, 6-5 Special, that whole period, you know, was basically what drove us. You know, we wanted to do that.
Well, the rock on the line, it's a mighty good road. Well, the rock on the line is the road to ride. Yeah, the rock on the line, it's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride it, gotta ride it like a finally get your ticket at the station on the rock on the line. Well, I may be right, I may be wrong. I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone.
I was like Lennon, John Lennon, because he used to make guitars and that you couldn't play, but it felt like a guitar. I used to do that in the cellar.
You mentioned a moment ago getting scalded by the kettle. You were living in Chapel House on Strang Road when that happened. What was the incident? It was a kettle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was either a kettle of boiling water or a pan with boiling water. But I only remember getting hold of the pan and pulling it off the table, and I don't remember anything after that. Because it's third degree.
You were in Nobles for a long time as well.
Yes, I was. I was given about 20 minutes.
To live? It was that serious, wasn't it?
Oh, it was very serious, but I have no memory of it.
Which is probably a good thing.
So the worst things that happen, you don't remember, you know?
But I suppose all of these things are sort of formative years, aren't they? And so there is something in that, isn't there, that sort of gives you the start in life?
Yeah, some kind of character building. I don't know. But it made me very strong because I didn't experience it. But I know that in my life, it's had a profound effect.
Do you know, you can tell talking to you that you do have this fabulous sort of spirituality about you. And I've picked up on something your mum was saying in her chat with Bernie. And she said, oh, Barry was here before, which I think is really lovely. What do you make of that?
Well, that's very interesting that my mum would say that, you know. But I never felt that this was my first time round. I never felt that. I felt that everything I was doing, I was already familiar with. I can't answer that. I can't figure it out. I just know that that's true.
It's an innate feeling, isn't it, sometimes? Barry, which schools did you actually go to when you were living on the island still?
Oh, there was the little one on right at the bottom of Bray Hill. And, of course, they had to turn right at the bottom of Bray Hill. And then you walk about maybe a quarter of a mile to the little school. Do you remember the name of the school? Because I've been trying to.
Was it Braddon School?
Yes. Yes, Braddon. It was Braddon.
Braddon School. There we go. Did you like school?
Well, no.
We like the honesty.
I never liked school because one of the first days at school, see, I'm very accident prone. So one of the first weeks at school, I got kicked in the head playing football. And from then on, I thought to myself, I don't like school, you know.
Not for you.
Not for me.
There's a story I heard, Barry, and you can tell me whether it's true or not, that when you and your brothers were out one day, you found a baby in a box floating down a stream.
That's correct.
Is it
that
true?
That is correct. Yes.
Did you ever find out any more about it or who it was or anything?
I tried. But we were standing at the side of the river in Spring Valley, and this box came floating down the river, and inside the box was a baby crying. So we picked the box out of the river. We took the baby in the box to a local house. It wasn't our house. It was another house. They took the baby from us, and we never heard anything more about it.
Wouldn't it be incredible if all these years later, somebody listening to this now picks up and says,
that.
Either that's me or it was my mum, whatever. If that's you, get in contact with us here at Manx Radio. We'd love to hear.
I'm the guy you dragged out the river. Thank you.
Do you know what? I have to say, it's so funny because obviously being Manx and from the Isle of Man, these stories, you know, I can relate to them. But when you moved to Oz first and then, of course, to the States, what did people make of it when you talked about this crazy little island? Because we've just talked about fairies and superstitions.
I never talked about it in that light. I always said, you know, we come from a place that's extremely spiritual, very ancient, and that was something we were proud of, very proud of. And it didn't matter where we go in the world, I'm a Manx man, and that's the end of it.
I have to ask you as well, you sort of talk about wherever you go in the world, you move from the Isle of Man to Manchester, but even on the Isle of Man, you Chapel House on Strang Road, then St Catherine's Drive, Smedley Cottage, Spring Valley, Snaefell Road, Williston, on and on. What was it like as a boy with your brothers and your older sister to move around so much?
Well, it was more about me moving around because they were still babies, you know. So I had a couple of friends in Williston especially. We watched what they were building on the hill opposite Williston. I think it was supposed to be a school, but I'll never know. But we watched them building it. And bonfire night was the big night. Williston was fantastic, but it was all council houses, you know. Mm-hmm. And before that, I think my favourite spot would have been Spring Valley.
Yeah, and of course, then you returned later and spent much more time here later on. But did you take certain traits with you then from those times on the Isle of Man, whether it was as a child or when you returned later? Do you think there's sort of an inherent Manxness that you've taken with you that you could put your finger on at all?
What I took with me was an extreme belief in the supernatural, an extreme belief in myth, mythical people, mythical creatures. And I left the island with those feelings, you know, because, you know, you might not have seen a fairy, but they were there. And it's a bit like Ireland in a way, but they had the different types of fairies. But I wonder if they were all real, you know, I don't know. But I never went across that bridge without saying hello.
A top tip from Sir Barry Gibb in 2025. We've touched on TT briefly. Did you have a favourite spot when you were here to go watch the racing from?
Well, you know, the second time we came back to the Isle of Man, we lived at the top of Bray Hill, at the very top opposite the church, you know. And once they took off, those guys, once they hit Bray Hill, that was something to see, you know, because you could hardly see them pass. You could hear them, but you couldn't really see them very well. They were doing like 200, 230 mile an hour down that hill. But what a thrill to have that happening every year, and people coming over with their own motorbikes and trying to be TT riders, you know. But there was only one Jeff Duke, And I remember watching Jeff Jew in his black leather outfit pushing the motorcycles. Do you remember how they used to push all the motorcycles? Yes. And how they worked, right? Fantastic period, fantastic.
Only a few seconds to go. Nerves are keyed up. There's the maroon and the flag's down. Will the engine start? Will it? Yes, he's off. And now here comes Jeff Duke. He's ridden a magnificent race so far at an average speed of 92¾ miles an hour. And now the last lap. Nothing but a breakdown can stop Duke winning now. But can he catch up Bill?
Well, you were so lucky to be on the island when you were, really, because there was that, obviously, the kind of that real heyday of the TT, but also the tourism over here then. I mean, the Isle of Man was positively booming, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The Tower of Refuge, the ships coming and going, and the Douglas area itself. That was a nice place to hang out. You could wander around. There was no threat. You know, you could wander around and have as much fun as you wanted to have. They let us playing in the pits of the motorcycle races, and I don't know why, but we did.
And to be honest, you can still do that now. It hasn't changed.
I'm delighted to say it's still very, very, very safe. We're very fortunate, but I am touching all of the wooden studio right now, just in case. I have to say, obviously, the boys would have been too young, but were you sad to leave the island when you were young, Barry?
Yes, I think I was. I was sad to leave. I was sad to leave that way of life. I was about, what, 5, 6? And ultimately, I was sad to leave Australia. So, you know, we've lived in 3 continents. And I think those 3 continents add up to something. I think you learn so much from each culture. And I think some of those things, being in the pyramids, being in the Tiger Balm Gardens in Singapore, and seeing places in the world that we never imagined we would ever see, you know? So it's all been a big sort of education. But it starts in the Isle of Man.
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. And I guess, I mean, obviously you've got children of your own, a number of children of your own. Is it 5, I think it is, isn't it? And their childhood would have been so very different to yours, I'm guessing.
Oh, my children, yeah, very different, because I think they were, except for Stephen, I think they were all born here in Miami. Stephen was born in London under the auspices of Dr. Roberts, who was the Beatles doctor. And the first child, that was amazing. That was amazing.
Did you, Barry, keep in touch with any of your Manx neighbours or childhood friends from that first period here?
No, every now and again I get a note or a letter from someone in the Isle of Man. But you know what? It's have you ever heard the song called Rank Strangers?
Oh, no, I don't.
No, we'll look that one up. We'll find that, yeah.
Better look that one up. It's the Stanley Brothers from early bluegrass, and they're singing about wandering back to their hometown, but everybody they met was a rank stranger, and everybody they knew was gone.
I wandered again through my home in the mountains, where a new surly dawn.
That's life, you know?
The place stays, the people change.
Well, people come and go, you know? And someone you knew back then might not even be around now, you know? So you never really know. Rank Strangers, that's the one.
going back, Barry, why did the family decide to move back to Manchester and then on to Australia at that period of time?
Certainly wouldn't have been my decision. So I think that was what Mum and Dad wanted to do. They wanted to go back to Manchester. He wanted to get a better job. It was all about how you lived after the war, the 10 years following the war, you know. And so we ended up back in Manchester, and it was freezing cold. We had a little Vauxhall, and that would freeze up, so you couldn't always use it. And it was that kind of life. You know, when you had your own street, and your own street, everyone knew each other. But on the next street, nobody knew each other. Mm-hmm. You know, it was your street. And like during the war, people at one end of your street might actually darn your socks at the other end of the street. So it was a time of great camaraderie because everyone wanted to forget about the war, get on with your lives. And that's when we first did our first appearance at the Gaumont Theatre and as a group.
You mentioned the war. There's a story I came across about your uncle Brian Pass on your mum's side,
yes,
who was a captain in the army. What's the story? Because
he was captured in Burma and held in a Japanese concentration camp. And he and a friend of his escaped on a lorry, but neither he nor the lorry were ever found again. So, my uncle Eric was in Palestine, you know, during the big change where Palestinians got their own land and Israel was formed. And he was one of those soldiers there, you know. I used to see his machine gun hanging in the hall.
Wow, from the time of the Mandate. And your granddad as well was a bit of a character. He fought in Gallipoli and then went on to be an early pilot for the fledgling Royal Flying Corps, didn't he?
Well, you know, I didn't know that.
Oh, there you go. Stick around, we'll pull up a pew, we'll keep going. bit of a character.
Do you know, on the understanding that you have a real fascination with history and heritage and that sort of side of things, and listening to you talking in the way you are about whether it's about the war, whether it's about, you know, the Isle of Man history and heritage, yes, or all the other places you've been. Do you think your interest in that is what sort of led to your music also having the depth that it does and the stories that you tell?
Absolutely. Absolutely, no question. What we saw going around the world and just being a family, you learn so much. You learn so much from different cultures. As I say, that, you know, we lived in three different continents. And if by any chance you're a writer, this is a huge boon. It's a huge help because you can go deep. You understand how everyone thinks because you've seen it in different ways.
And it also enables you to connect with people on a different level, doesn't it? Because, I mean, your lyrics are not throwaway. There is something to them that someone somewhere is going to absolutely latch onto and relate to.
Yes. Yes, you do. I have a deep understanding of people. Just people, because we've lived in so many places. And so when you're writing songs, all of that kind of information creeps in, you know, and you go as deep as you want. You can go as deep as you want.
I think as well, it's also, we did a documentary some years ago with another musician from the Isle of Man by the name of Davy Knowles, who's a brilliant blues guitarist. So do you know Davy?
I don't personally, but I've heard of him, yes.
Oh, that's great that you have. So he's in Chicago now and he's doing very well. So he's done some great stuff. But we did a documentary with him about the movement of music, not just sort of across the continents and across cultures, but through history as well, and the way that music tells stories. And I guess that's also a way of preserving history, isn't it? And also, I guess, learning lessons as well. It's an education too.
So, yes, I'm a fanatic on early country music. I'm a fanatic on bluegrass. Mm-hmm. And I'm, at this time of my life, I'm just, all I do is listen and study how that all came about. The immigrants, the Scottish immigrants, the Irish immigrants who brought their instruments to America, and how that music began. And it's the simplicity, and as you just said, the storytelling. The songs with stories that really hit you in the heart come from that part of the country, Nashville and the Appalachian Mountains and the Bluegrass Mountains. And it all comes from the mountains for some reason. Listen to Rank Strangers and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
We'll check that out. Talking of music back in the 70s, the Eagles had a song called Hotel California, which contains the line, you can check out anytime you like, you can never leave. Back in the sort of mid-70s, you came back to the island, much to do with Labour's tax rate and everything else. What was it like to come back to the island at that point?
Oh, incredible. Incredible. It was a quick trip, but once again to be back on Manx soil, and I knew the island really well, so I could drive around anywhere in the Isle of Man and know where I was. You know, it was home. You know.
Around the time you came back to the Isle of Man, you also sort of, with the your brothers, ended up playing the Northern Club Circuit in England in places like Batley Variety Club. How did that feel after the massive success you'd enjoyed earlier stateside?
Well, you shouldn't confuse those things, because we had two number one records in America when we did Batley's. So for us, we were just doing shows so we could stay home, so we could be in England for a while. But Roy Orbison had worked those places, and Chuck Berry had worked those places, and it didn't hurt us at all to get back to smaller audiences, chicken in the basket, that way of life, you know.
They're some of the best gigs, aren't you? And I wonder as well if, because, I mean, you've...
We were not suffering at that point. Yeah. We were having huge success in America, so it's a bit of a confusion about what was going on at that point.
And I think as well, one of the things about you all, you retained your humility throughout. And again, it's one of those things, I wonder if that maybe started with your sort of like upbringing on the Isle of Man, because there is that thing, isn't there, about the Manxy sort of saying, you know, the Manx crab syndrome of keep yourself humble. You're not allowed to do well over it.
Well, that's true. It's really true in Australia. If you have a driver Rolls Royce, they'll take the wheels off your car. You know, so it's that kind of environment. I don't think that ever happened in the Isle of Man, but it's the beginning of everything. It's the beginning of everything. The original inspiration for us was living in the Isle of Man. It really was. And we learned so much spiritually from it, even as children. There was always something, there was always magic in the air, you know? Because of all of the mythology and the ancient history that seemed to emanate from the Isle of Man, including the mist. You know, the mist when it surrounds the island? Mm-hmm. All of those things. It became a very mystical place, a very magical place. You'd want to be 5 or 6 years old to appreciate it.
Oh, I was there, don't you worry. And I wonder, when you came back in the 70s, of course, you know, really, I wonder if you hadn't been here then, whether actually the whole Saturday Night Fever phenomenon would have been what it was, because it was when you were here and you'd already written those songs, hadn't you, that you got the call from Robert about the film.
No, I had the titles. Uh-huh. Robert Stigwood called me up and asked me if I had any ideas for this film. And I had a song called Staying Alive, I had a song called Night Fever, More Than a Woman, If I Can't Have You. And Robert didn't particularly like Night Fever. I said, well, you know, you're asking me and I'm just telling you these are ideas I have. So what he must have done was added Saturday into Night Fever, and that's how it ended up.
Because the original title was Tribal Rights of a New Saturday Night, wasn't it?
Well, no, that was the title of an article in a newspaper by a writer writing about that time. And that was his headline.
All came from that, which is just an incredible story and how that leads in. You shot a video for Jive Talking here on the Isle of Man. It was fairly short notice, wasn't it? How did that come about?
It was. It's a very strange video. I think Robert wanted some kind of visual idea for Jive Talking, you know? And so we did that. I'm not, maybe the Douglas Bay Hotel, somewhere in the Douglas Bay Hotel, I think we recorded that. And this was the beginning of that era, what you call the disco era. So we had no idea where we were going. And truthfully, we had no idea where we were going to end up. So, you know, you always look forward, but you don't know what's going to happen. And it just all exploded and we were just baffled by it.
Is it true? I heard a story, Barry, that they tried to get you to change the lyrics to Staying Alive to Saturday Night at one point.
Robert preferred it if we called the song Saturday Night, but I said, no, because the Bay City Rollers had a song called Saturday Night. And I didn't want that to happen. I said, you're kicking the nuts out of the song. The song doesn't mean Saturday Night. The song means all of us are trying to coexist. That's what the song means.
Looking back now, I've heard sort of various thoughts over the years from you and your brothers about the whole Saturday Night Fever project, the album, the soundtrack. In 2025, as you look back, where's your head at now, Barry? Are you glad you were involved?
Yes, and more so, it was one of the best times of our lives, you know? We had 5 songs in the top 10 in America. We had 3 songs in the top 5 in America. And you can't ask for any more than that, you know? To me, a hit is a hit. And we were sort of censored, along with that whole form of music began to get censored in favor of something else. The something else I never understood, but I did understand that you can, maybe like Phil Collins and other people, you can become ostracized if you're too successful. And I think, you know, if you look back far enough, you'll see that with Elvis, you'll see it with the Beatles, you see it with Michael Jackson, you know, that at some stage, everybody wants to change. And we understood that. We weren't happy about it, but we were raising children and we were building families and life just changed. So we were able to put food on the table, we were able to raise our kids, and we were able to live in the sun. So, you know, I don't regret any of that.
Oh, that's wonderful. And, I love the fact as well that when you did speak with Bernie Quayle, when he did those long interviews with you over there in Miami, it was just about the time that you'd finished working on Immortality and the Night Fever musical was about to open. So it hadn't yet opened. It was about to open at that time. So the idea that it kind of came full circle when Bernie was talking to you about your times on the Isle of Man and the musical was about to open to this enormous success is quite a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Yes. All in all, Yes, it was a very beautiful, the whole experience has been beautiful. And at my age now, I don't look forward so much as, isn't it funny how as you get older, the things behind you are far more interesting than the things in front of you. And as life, you can't look forward to a much longer life, but you can enjoy the memories. And so that's what I do. That's what I do.
Eventually, there was a kickback to the disco movement, as you've talked about. I'm going to mention 2 words to you, and I just want to get your reaction from that period of time, Barry. Kenny Everett.
Oh, Kenny, jeez. Yeah, I love Kenny Everett. He's fantastic. Very quick, very brittle mind. And we used to love him. We loved him.
What did you make of the skit when you first saw that?
Loved it.
So, you've decided to become a Bee Gee. Don't touch that bottle. I'll tell you when to touch the bottles. Now, you puny little nobody, we'll begin to make you into a world-famous BG. First, you'll need the world-famous BG teeth. Now you can touch the bottles. Take 1 pill from bottle A. Good. The shirt open to the navel, exposing hairy chest and revealing large golden medallion pill. Or as I call it, bottle B. Stage 3, bottle C. You'll be needing the world famous BG hair. Look at you. Yes, not bad. But there's something missing. You're only 1, then there should be 3. Take bottle D. Now you'll need the most important part of a BG, the world famous vibrato. Will you all pick up the vibrato bottles and keep taking the pills until the required bottle is achieved?
You children of the world. Anyone who imitates us in any way, shape or form is a compliment. You know?
What a fantastic attitude to have and so different to some people. What did you think, let's take the story forward a little bit, what did you think when Bernie Quayle first suggested recording the song Ellen Vanin?
Well, you know, I don't remember him suggesting that, but I'm glad he did. because I think Robin did a beautiful version and it was us saying, talking to the Isle of Man. You know, because we never forgot Ellen Bannon. We never forgot that.
When the summer day is over, its busy cares have flown, I will sit beneath the starlight with a weary heart and love.
Yeah, I didn't know it was Bernie, but I'm glad it was.
Yeah, it was. And it raised a lot of money as well for the Rebecca House
Hospice. That's right, I remember now.
And then when you came back again to receive the freedom of the borough of Douglas, which was yourself and Robin at that point, which must be wonderful. And I want to raise that because you just talked about Kenny Everett. And I think one of the things about you all is your incredible sense of humour, like the madcap sense of humour you've all had is wonderful. And you apparently, when you came over for freedom of the borough, our pal Dot Tilbury, who did the stamps with you, said that they couldn't drag you away from Norman Wisdom.
No, that's true. Just to meet the man in person was fantastic. And I think Robin was the same. We couldn't believe that after all the years we were going to meet Norman Wisdom, you know. And he's a legend and we loved him. We laughed at everything. Everything to us was a sense of humour. You know?
Talking about appearances and TV things, there's a famous clip of you being asked in the TV programme An Audience with the Bee Gees by the actress Angela Griffin about whether you came from Manchester or Australia, and the audience seemed genuinely surprised when you told them the truth.
Well, you know, I've that feeling, that opinion has evolved. I feel patriotic to three places in life: the Isle of Man, Australia, and America. And we have lived in those three places, experienced those three cultures, and that's had an incredible impact on if you're a writer, incredible. You learn from all those different cultures and those different ways of thinking.
On that TV show, at least Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones knew what the Iron Man was and that it had the three legs.
Yeah.
He made reference to it, didn't he? So at least you knew.
I think so.
What was it like to perform Ellen Vanin at that event? Because that was probably the first time I remember seeing it. And it was so poignant. It was so powerful.
Well, you know, Robin had a magnificent voice. And he wanted to sing that song. I just remember the whole night being an amazing night. I remember sitting and having a drink with Bill Wyman afterwards. And it was a delight. The whole thing was a delight. And Alan Bannon has had a great effect on us spiritually. So, you know, I don't remember the particular moment during that show, but that version, Robin's version of Alan Bannon, is magnificent.
As you sit here now, Barry, you're in Miami, sipping your pineapple juice, chatting with Christy and myself here at Douglas Head on the Isle of Man. What do you feel when you stop and think of that song and its significance to both the island, where it's so powerful, and to you and your brothers?
Well, it's the place we came from. It's our roots. It's the mythology and the idea that there was something magic about it all. And, you know, from catching tadpoles to driving a car around the island when I got older, none of those things have gone away. They're all very vivid, very vivid. What a magnificent place.
And you've obviously taken it with you, haven't you? And do you talk to your own children about the Isle of Man much?
Yes, sometimes. I was in an antique bookshop in Eton, and I found a very tiny book called The Isle of Man. And it's written in about 1916, maybe 1910. And it's worth getting if you can catch it, because the information in that book is what was going on then, what was actually happening, the first trams, the first of everything. And it was in this book, and I discovered it accidentally, and I still have it.
And it must be satisfying to you to know now that finally, after much work by Bernie before he passed, and also his sister, my mum, Pauline, that now there is the statue of you all on the promenade, which has had so many people come to visit it, you know, to take photos next to you striding on the promenade, the three of you in your flares hair.
I didn't know the statue had eventually ended up being done. I haven't seen a picture of it as it is now.
Oh, we'll have to send it to you.
We'll get one over to you. We'll get one over to you, most certainly.
Please, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it in real life. I'd just love to see it in real life.
Well, the invite's there, Barry. We're not going to say no to that.
I'm coming. I'm just not sure when. I've had particularly bad arthritis in my legs, so I haven't been moving around very well, but my head still works.
Which is the important bit? We mentioned the statue. Christy touched on the stamps, the BG stamps that the Isle of Man Post Office issued in 1999. Again, a Bernie Quayle idea, which got the approval of Dot Tilbury at the Post Office. Yes. In a way, that kind of took your story full circle, because your mum, Barbara, obviously once ran the sub-post office in Union Mills. What did you make
that's
of
right.
that?
Yeah, that's great. I couldn't believe they did that. But I remember being with them, watching one of the races at that particular spot. I know, that was crazy. That was crazy. Why would they suddenly end up with the post office? You know, it was always a question mark to me.
Well, it was Bernie Quayle. Do you still have a copy of the stamps yourself?
Oh, yes. On the wall.
And, you know, it was a wonderful time, because I know Dot Tilbury, who was the postmaster at the time, who sort of, she was, whether or not you remember this, I don't know, but she was the very loud Manx woman who would have been accompanying all the media junkets. She said there were 28 different interviews all in the space of about a week about your Bee Gees Isle of Man stamps, which, just talk about putting the Isle of Man on the map again. I mean, the profile.
Well, I don't know if I ever had that feeling the Isle of Man needed anyone to endorse it, because it's a world famous place. It's a sacred place.
It is. And so what did it mean to you then when you got the call about receive the freedom of the borough? What did that mean to you then?
Well, it's an incredible thrill, an incredible honour to have people say you belong here, you know, to have people say that to you. And I remember times when people would go from one side of the island to the other for a holiday, because they'd never been to the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always intriguing. Peel and Peel Castle, and the smell of the ocean was it's a different smell than it is here, than it is in Miami. It's a totally different odor, and it's not forgettable. It's wonderful. It's pure sea life. But Peel Castle, that whole area, that was where we would go for fun.
I'm going to ask a question now, which Christy won't, because she'll be modest, because it was her uncle. But were it not for Bernie Quayle's perseverance all those years ago and coming to America and seeking you out, the whole Bee Gees Isle of Man connection may have been forgotten. No statue, no stamps, no Freedom of Douglas, no awesome cover of Ellen Fanning. What does what Bernie achieved then mean to you now?
Yeah, I think he did things for us that other people had not done or not bothered about. He kept the relationship between us and the Isle of Man real and solid. And I do that now. So, you know, yes, he made a lot of things possible, and we have a lot to thank him for.
What did you think when you first got the call saying there was this guy from the Isle of Man coming over to see you in America and he wanted to spend a bit of time and talk to you?
I remember that very well. He came to Wilton Place, which is place we have in Beaconsfield, spent quite a bit of time together, and he wanted to do this charity thing that seemed to have worked out in some way or another. But I only saw him for a short while. You know, I think he spent more time with Robin than he did with me. But Bernie is not someone you forget.
It's amazing when you think about it, because you lads all had a very similar sort of start, obviously here on the Isle of Man. And then he also, in his own industry, this little guy from the island, went off and ended up, you know, doing extremely well in his chosen industry of the media with radio and video. And, you know, he met Janis Joplin. He introduced Michael Jackson onto the stage. He, you know, did all these sort of incredible interviews, and yet again also absolutely retained his humility and that brilliant sense of humour, which I think comes from the Isle of Man.
Yeah, no, Bernie was a great man. And he extended himself. He. There was something else going on inside Bernie that was going to work in other places, not just the Isle of Man. He got busy, and he was good. He was good at what he did.
Barry, as we come towards the end of chatting to you, the Isle of Man has its famous three legs of man. In many ways, you, Morris and Robin could be seen as the three legs of man yourselves.
I thought of that, but that would have been my ego. But we always, the three legs of man is embedded inside us. And it's to show that to other people that might not have even seen those three legs. That's it. That's where we come from. I'm not sure which leg I would have been.
Answers on a postcard to Manx Radio. I have one last question for you, Barry, and that's 2025. What would you like the Bee Gees' legacy to the Isle of Man to be?
That the two are connected completely. That's what I'd like to see, and I'd like everyone to know that that's where it began for us. You know, it's a sacred place, and it always will be. And I'm always gonna be ready to talk about it, because I've never forgotten much of anything about the Isle of Man. It's all there. Love that place.
You said now that you're going to come back and see us. So we're going to hold you to that.
I am, because I want to stand in the statue.
We have to get that image. I think I will send you, as soon as we finish, we'll send you a photo. I think you'll be really, really pleased with it. It's a beautiful thing. And so we've had various celebrities come over to the island who want their photo taken with you in bronze.
Oh, no, it's an amazing thing. Isn't it really?
It is. That
you could go and see a statue of yourself.
That's going to feel a bit strange, it's got to be said.
Yeah, but wonderful as well, you know.
So Barry Gibb, thank you so much for taking the time in Miami this evening to spend a little bit of time chatting with us here on good old Douglas Head on the Isle of Man. It's been a real privilege and a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I love the island, I love you guys, and I'll be back as soon as I can. I promise you that.
When the summer day is over, its busy cares have flown, I will sit beneath the starlight with a weary heart and love. Then it rises like a vision, sparkling bright, it shines for me. My own dear element with its green hills by.
You've been listening to a Manx Radio exclusive with Sir Barry Gibb, chatting with Christy DeHaven and Chris Pearson. The show was produced by Chris Pearson, with additional material from Duke Video and the late Bernie Quayle. It was brought to you by Manx National Heritage, a precious charity protecting the heritage of our beautiful island. You can hear the full podcast of the show online anytime at manxradio.com.